Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, January 17th. On this Martin Luther King Day, let's begin with two historical sound bites and one from this weekend with a little bit of context. 1963 was the year that Dr. King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. That was at the big March on Washington in August of that year, an important moment, obviously, that helped in the progress toward the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964. It was a few months yet before President Kennedy would be assassinated, and the pressure was really being placed on him to get more active about civil rights legislation as well as on Congress. Dr. King's line about judging people by the content of their character has been widely quoted, overquoted, and even distorted to mean color shouldn't be taken into account when addressing racial injustice. His belief in nonviolence has been widely reduced to exclude the fact that he was carrying out forceful, nonviolent acts of civil disobedience because he was a nonviolent change agent, not just a passive asker. So for many people, the text and speech that deserves at least as much historical spotlight as I Have a Dream was the one from just a few months earlier, in the spring of 63, when King was in jail in Birmingham, Alabama, for leading nonviolent civil disobedience there. Here is Dr. King reading from his letter from a Birmingham jail, citing a particularly painful moment that a Southern parent might have faced.
When you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television.
King's words from 1963, before I Have a Dream. It's a lesson because from today's perspective, it seems obvious to most Americans that an amusement park or any other private business should not legally be able to ban people on the basis of their race, right? But here's another historical clip from back then of South Carolina Senator Strom Thurmond opposing civil rights legislation. This is from the same year, 1963. In a debate with Senator Hubert Humphrey on CBS television, and as you'll hear, Thurmond twists the idea of government guaranteeing equal treatment to government telling private business what to do.
It empowers the national government to tell each citizen who must be allowed to enter upon and use his property without any compensation or due process of law as guaranteed by the Constitution. This bill would take away the rights of individuals and give to government the power to decide who is to be hired, fired, and promoted in private businesses.
Strom Thurmond in 1963, when he was still a Democrat, seeing racial equality as unconstitutional. A few years earlier, in 1957, if you don't know this history, he had filibustered an earlier, weaker Civil Rights Act by speaking continuously on the Senate floor for just over 24 hours. It was one of the most famous uses of the filibuster, but by no means the only one against equal rights. The landmark Civil Rights Act passed in 64 only after a filibuster by West Virginia Democrat Robert Byrd, and by the way, it was broken because Senate Republican leader Everett Dirksen rounded it up enough GOP votes to end it and move the bill forward. The final speech in opposition to that bill was given by Georgia Democrat Richard Russell, who had once famously said during a six-day filibuster that he had led against the civil rights bill way back in the 1930s, quote, the quote was that he was, quote, willing to go as far and make as great a sacrifice to preserve and ensure white supremacy, he just said it out loud, white supremacy, in the social, economic, and political life of our state as any man who lives within her borders. So filibuster has a long history of being used against civil rights. And yet, by the way, they later named one of the main Senate office buildings after Russell. After the 1964 Act passed, As many of you know, some of you may not, things changed for the two political parties. Strom Thurmond switched parties and became a Republican. He chastised the Democrats for having, quote, forsaken the people to become the party of minority groups. Forsaken the people to become the party of minority groups. I guess he didn't consider members of minority groups people. And ever since that moment, Democratic presidential candidates have never again won a majority of white voters as they had before. They've averaged only 40% starting with the 1968 presidential election. So maybe it's no surprise, and maybe it's not just about Donald Trump, that Trump used Martin Luther King's actual birthday on Saturday not to give a speech about civil rights or the 10-to-1 ratio of wealth that whites continue to have compared to blacks, or the disproportionate death and misery toll that COVID has taken on black Americans compared to whites. Instead, he used King's birthday, like Strom Thurmond might have, to portray whites in America as the racially aggrieved party by stating this falsehood about how COVID treatments are distributed.
You get it based on race. In fact, in New York State, if you're white, you have to go to the back of the line to get medical help. Think of it. If you're white, you go right to the back of the line.
That, of course, is false. The truth that he was twisting, as fact-checked by multiple news organizations, is that because of the socioeconomic history that has led black and Latino Americans to be statistically at greater risk for serious effects from COVID, race is listed as one risk factor to be taken into account when determining courses of treatment. But Trump sees a meaningful percentage of the white public ready to believe on King's birthday that they are the ones who need more rights today as he prepares to potentially mobilize as much of the white vote as he can for 2024 and for his candidates in the midterms this year. So with all of that as prelude, two clips from 1963, one from this weekend that shows history as a continuum, we welcome Kai Wright, host of the WNYC podcast and Sunday night call-in show, The United States of Anxiety. Hi, Kai. Welcome back to this show.
Hey, Brian. You fairly well laid it out there. That's a fairly striking set of background.
So as a matter of history, first, I mean, Strom Thurmond switched parties and took a lot of white America with him. The Civil Rights of 1964, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, was not just a human rights turning point. It was a real political turning point in this country, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I would, you know, I'm glad you gave that stat about who has voted for what as president over the years since then. I mean, I would just slightly twist the framing. It's not that Democrats haven't won white voters. White voters have refused to vote for a Democrat in a majority since the 1964 Civil Rights Act, including Barack Obama. I mean, there is a real sort of fog of memory, even shortly, over, you know, how much he proved about how we're past race in our country. A majority of white voters did not vote for Barack Obama in either of his elections. And it's also a reminder of something else from history, is that how quickly mainstream opinion, which is to say white opinion, turned against civil rights in general following both the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. I mean, it was a very quick pivot to say, you know, hey, a lot's going on here. Let's slow this down. There was a brief window of support, and very quickly they turned against these ideas and against King. That's another thing we forget, you know. He was not popular in his lifetime. And particularly, you quote the letter from a Birmingham jail. I mean, the point of that letter, at the core of that letter, was that liberal whites, moderate whites, self-identified moderates, were telling him, chill out, slow That's down, right. Quit asking for so much so yes. fast. And his rejoinder was, we cannot wait. We cannot continue to wait. It was a big turning point in that it was a moment in which white America said, we cannot brook this much change this fast, and we're still we're still recovering from that. But I'll say one more thing before I is that it was a big turning point for democracy, because what the Voting Rights Act was remarkably successful. I mean, this was a remarkably successful piece of legislation, arguably, you know, one of the most successful laws in our history. Democracy expanded wildly from 1965 through until quite recently. It launched an era of just rapid and sustained expansion of democracy in America, that, of the sort that we had not seen since right after the Civil War.
Yeah, and I want to focus on that and dive a little deeper, since the voting rights legislation that's up before Congress right now is obviously the front and center issue on this King Day in 2022. But it's interesting to hear the rhetoric of Strom Thurmond, and in the context of, you know, before the basic civil rights mm-hmm. laws were passed, and how similar it is to some of the rhetoric today, where he says it's about government telling you what to do, and he doesn't even get into the equal treatment aspects of it, because one of the things I referenced in the intro is that I think the vast majority of white Americans today would agree that it's unconscionable for an amusement park, to take the example in the Dr. King clip, to say you can't come in because you're black. Yeah. It's completely unacceptable today. You'd probably get, 95%, tell me if you disagree, I think you'd get 95% or something like that, white agreement that we shouldn't go back to something like that. And yet, some similar language is used to block advancement toward more equality in real life, not just on paper. Yeah.
I mean, well, I think I would agree you'd get 95% white agreement, though it is worth noting we live in an enormously segregated society even today. So what yeah. we say versus what we do in modern times might, our actions might be a little closer to the past. But I'd say, one of the things that's important there is, Strom Thurmond was not only saying beware of the government telling you what to do. He was saying beware of the government telling you what to do with your property, which is an important piece of it. I mean, this was another thing that is sort of scrubbed from King's legacy. His core message was, the problem with the United States, where we have a corruption in our values, is this triple evil of materialism, racism, and militarism. He used this phrase, a thing-oriented society. That was our core problem. We had this thing-oriented society that placed property over people, property over human rights, property over community, and that was a core part of what he wanted to address. And that, of course, that idea of placing property over humanity goes back to slavery. That's the core idea there, was that we have property, it is in these people, and we have to defend our property rights. And that has been in the core of a part of American politics since slavery, and that you heard it in that Strom Thurmond quote, and you hear it quite often today. It is in people's minds divorced from that history, because again, part of the political project of white supremacy is to erase history. But so it's a divorced from that history, but that thing oriented society, that is a big part of what we faced then, what we face now, and what King wanted us to think about.
So Kai, let's get back to voting rights, because that's front and center right now. In 2013, the Supreme Court overturned, this is, more recent history, but I still think a lot of people don't know this and couldn't name this if you just sort of ask them, say, what happened with voting rights? Why are we having this come? In 2013, the Supreme Court overturned the part of the Voting Rights Act of 65 that had required ongoing Justice Department approval over voting law changes in states like South Carolina, where Strom Thurmond had come from, and Georgia, where Richard Russell had come from. They said, the court said in 2013 that it was wrong to base that requirement forever on things from decades ago. And Kai, my question is, we have seen big turnout elections like the 2020 election, when Biden won Georgia and the two Democratic Senate candidates famously won Georgia, largely because of big turnouts by black voters. So has the Supreme Court decision had any real discriminatory impact, in your opinion or observation?
I mean, I think it's quite starkly clear that it's had this massive impact. I mean, the just if you look at the number of voter suppression laws that have passed since then. I mean, it gave license to states to begin passing laws that are moving at a record pace. I mean, there were 19 states passed laws last year, dozens and dozens of bills to restrict access to voting. And there are many more in the pipeline. There are those who argue that is a greater wave of Democratic restriction than we have seen since Martin Luther King's days. And I think it's helpful to just, again, think about the sweep of history in this tug of war over democracy, and I think really go all the way back, I hope I get these stats right there. Mississippi, I think it was, in one southern state. Now I'm not even going to remember the state. Following the Civil War, during Reconstruction, there was 66% black voter registration in the years following the Civil War. We don't think about that. 66% black voter registration. That same state, and I can't remember the southern state, I'm sorry, but by the time we got to just before the Civil Rights Act, there was 4% black voter registration. So democracy shrank rapidly and stayed shrunk for many years following the Civil War. It wasn't born shrunk. It had the 15th Amendment came along. We had an expansion of democracy. There was a backlash to it. It re-shrunk. And the Civil Rights Movement brought us the Voting Rights Act, which again grew democracy. And it grew for decades. For decades, it grew through bipartisan agreement. And not only with black voters. I mean, it was also passage of, they updated the law to include language parity rules so that it grew people who were not native English speakers were able to vote, to make it easier for young people to vote. There were all this bipartisan agreement on the growth of democracy that changed with George Bush's administration, with George W. Bush's administration, when the Justice Department under George W. Bush began this lie of voter fraud. That is where this began. And it has been since then that we have seen this growth in voter suppression. So it's important to think about that Supreme Court ruling, but it is also important to think about the anti-democratic movement that began with the Bush administration and exploded following the 2008 election, following Obama's election. That's when we started to really see this wave of state level laws. This was after, and then particularly in 2010, when the Tea Party wave election happened, we began to see this wave of state laws constricting democracy. That was the first time we've seen that since 1965. It's really important to understand that, that this was a modern turn. And then again, now following 2020, we've seen just an explosion. So the Supreme Court gave the green light for it. And there has, just like during the Civil Rights Movement, there's been massive organizing in some of these elections. That's in spite of the efforts of state legislatures to keep voting down. We've seen some surges in voting, but the darkness is coming. Like the laws we saw passed last year are going to be on the books, and it is going to be. If voting experts are to be believed, we are entering into a very dangerous era in terms of how hard it's going to be for people to vote in many, many states in this country.
And we should probably say, since there are three voting rights bills on the table right now, and people can get confused as to what's in each of them, the John Lewis voting rights bill specifically reinstates that pre-clearance requirement, but it doesn't go all the way back to the Jim Crow era. A state could have done something wrong in the 1950s that was racist and discriminatory that doesn't get taken into account by the Justice Department today. It sets a 25-year timeline. So 25 years back from today, I mean, that doesn't even go to 1990. You know, right, it's so recent. If a state has been found to have a record of discriminatory voting laws, then the Justice Department needs to look at any other voting law changes that come down. I mean, that's the heart of the John Lewis bill, right?
Correct. And then there are a variety of other prescriptions in the Freedom to Vote Act that are about, one, stopping the sort of partisan taking over of election administration, I believe there's some stuff on the gerrymandering, but the core of the John Lewis Act, you're right, is about basically restoring the Voting Rights Act to its pre-2015 level of strength.
By the way, one more date in history, since you brought up the Bush administration and how its Justice Department started to do what it did and laid the
intellectual grounds for the movement we're seeing now.
Right. It was in 2006, and this has come up on this show recently and, you know, some other places that are covering the current voting rights debate closely. In 2006, the Senate voted 98 to nothing. Presumably by that math, there would have been a few Republicans in that vote, 98 to nothing, to renew the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So even then, 6 out of the 8 years into the Bush administration, all the Republicans in the Senate were willing to continue to sign on to voting rights as they had been.
Yeah, it was very much Barack Obama's election that turned this conversation again. I think it's important to remember the sort of intellectual roots of it with the Bush administration and John Ashcroft's Justice Department and creating this notion of voter fraud, right? Which is what is the sort of thinly veiled justification for everything that follows. But the real explosion of turning the Republican Party into an anti-democratic party happened following the 2008 election. And when the wave of elections in 2010 gave those anti-democratic Republicans, small d democratic Republicans, control of that many state legislatures, it just was off and running. But even still, the Brennan Center says there were more bills passed last year than they've seen in the entirety of that 10-year period that they were tracking voter suppression bills.
We thank Kai Wright, host of the United States of Anxiety, the WNYC podcast, and Sunday night, 6 o'clock, live call-in show. Listeners, if you like this live call-in show Monday through Friday, we have one on the weekends, and it's Kai's Sunday nights at 6, the United States of Anxiety. Kai, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.